From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Obama has designated two new national monuments in Nevada and Utah. Bear's Ears in southeastern Utah and Gold Butte in southern Nevada are both desert regions that contain Native American cultural treasures. And Obama named them protected national monuments under the Federal Antiquities Act. So just what is the Antiquities Act and why does it cause so much modern-day controversy? Patrick Parento is a professor of law and senior counsel at the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Clinic at Vermont Law School, and he joins us. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Well, first of all, during President Obama's tenure in the White House, he's used the Antiquities Act some 29 times to designate 29 national monuments, more than any other president. So first of all, can you tell us about these two new national monuments, Bear's Ears and Gold Butte, and what the designation will do for them?
Yes, these are two areas that have been considered for designation as national monuments for a long time, and they've been very controversial. They both involve what is an estimated over 100 archaeological sites tied as far back as 3,000 years ago to some of the first peoples that inhabited North America. There are a lot of Pueblo sites. These are sites sacred to five different Native American tribes in the West. They also contain some very unique geologic formations, the Gold Butte Monument in particular. They are wildlife corridors for bighorn sheep and so forth. So they have multiple natural values, cultural values, and very significant to the native tribes out there.
Okay, interesting. Well, I see that Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz of Utah, Republican of Utah, says, quote, that this move is a slap in the face of the people of Utah. Why that reaction?
Well, there's a lot of public land, of course, in Utah. 65% of the state is in federal ownership. So there's this tense relationship between the federal government and the state over how those lands should be managed. There's always controversies over whether the mineral resources of these areas should be exploited or they should be used for grazing and off-road vehicle use and other activities. The monument designation will curtail some of those activities and certainly the major activities that would damage the archaeological resources there. And so there's a fight over the control of these lands, which is, I suppose, understandable.
So let's go back in time here and talk about the creation of the Antiquities Act itself. It happened in 1906 when President Teddy Roosevelt signed it into law. How did it come about?
It came about in response to reports that a lot of these important archaeological and other resources on federal lands were being vandalized. Of course, in the early days of the 1900s, there weren't the federal agencies on the ground to manage these lands. So they were pretty much open to anybody who wanted to go on and do whatever they were going to do. So the idea of the Antiquities Act was to give the president the power to move very quickly in response to threats to some of these resources. And then, of course, over time, the Antiquities Act application has been broadened. And in fact, it's given us some of our major national parks, including Grand Canyon, Zion, Grand Teton. And so the Antiquities Act has been a key part of preserving America's natural heritage ever since its enactment in 1906.
And it's even been used, the president has used it for marine monument designations, right?
That's correct. It's been used to designate the Statue of Liberty to protect it. And sometimes it's been used for very small areas. The big controversy, of course, now is over these designations of very large areas. The Bear Ears Monument is 1.35 million acres. So there you're talking about large areas. But of course, you're also talking about a vast landscape in the West.
Mm. Well, so as you mentioned before, though, there is this tension between these federal designations and what state and local officials and residents may want to do with the land. So there's been talk that President-elect Trump may undo some of President Obama's designations. Could the government go a step further and actually do away with the Antiquities Act altogether? How hard would that be?
Well, Congress certainly could do that because under the Constitution, Congress has what we call plenary power over federal land. So Congress can do what it wishes with the Antiquities Act. But of course, there have been many attempts over the years to either modify the act or perhaps outright appeal it. None of those efforts have played out so far. Now we have both houses of Congress under Republican control and, of course, the White House soon to be under Republican control. So it's possible that you might see some major changes to the Antiquities Act. I suppose it's possible that Congress could muster the votes to repeal it, but that seems unlikely to me. These lands have become extremely popular over time. So these areas that have been designated as monuments have their own very powerful constituency.
Well, Patrick Parento is professor of law and senior counsel at the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Clinic at Vermont Law School. Professor Parento, thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.
Hollywood had its monumental figures, and Debbie Reynolds was one of them. She could dance, sing, act, and she worked hard at all of it. Reynolds died last night at the age of 84, just a day after her daughter Carrie Fisher died. Richard Barrios is a musical film historian. His latest book is called Dangerous Rhythm, Why Movie Musicals Matter. Hello, Richard.
Hi.
Debbie Reynolds was Hollywood gold, so it's easy to forget that she was not born into the theater and she was not destined for stardom. How did it all happen for her?
It's almost like a Hollywood fictional story. She got into a beauty contest when she was in high school, and she didn't even think she was going to win, and she ended up winning, and there was a talent scout in the audience. So it all resulted in a movie contract for her, totally unprepared and everything else, but she got it.
Well, when she did Singin' in the Rain for MGM, she became a megastar with Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor. But she always said that that film was incredibly hard. I mean, she said as hard as childbirth. Why was it so difficult?
Mainly because Gene Kelly and Stanley Donen, the directors, drove her very hard, very, very demandingly with the dancing. She had danced a little on film, but nothing like what was involved with this, and they really pushed her.
There's one kind of legendary story about her being so upset. Again, she was 19 years old then, and she was so tired and so drawn out that she kind of hid under the piano and cried.
In the rehearsal studio, and she was there just in total agony and not thinking she could get through with it. And she saw a pair of legs kind of near her while she was under the piano, and then she peeked out and looked up, and it was Fred Astaire. And he commiserated with her and told her that this was the kind of thing he went through all the time, and just to keep with it, and she'll get it. And she was very heartened by that, and so she picked up and went and did it, and it made her a star.
One of her next stops was the film Tammy, and this really enhanced her as a singer.
The song's popularity is what made the movie popular. The song took off so fast and so greatly that they actually had to bring the movie back to kind of reissue it based on the popularity of the song. And then it became a hit, and it kind of made people rethink her stardom.
Let's give it a listen.
I hear the cottonwoods whispering above, Tammy, Tammy, Tammy. In love.
What do you hear in that, Richard?
It's a very sincere voice. There are no tricks. There's no artifice. It's almost as if she's talking. And that was one of the reasons she was a star, became a star, and stayed a star for 65 years. You know, there was this girl next door quality, and it's why everybody always kind of rooted for her.
People really rooted for her when she had that terrible personal turmoil when she was married to Eddie Fisher, and then Eddie Fisher turned around and married one of their close friends, Elizabeth Taylor. Why did that become such a Hollywood spectacle?
Partly because she and Eddie Fisher in the mid-1950s were sort of Hollywood's golden young couple. It looked from the outside that there was this storybook romance. He was close friends with the producer, Michael Todd, and she was at MGM with Mrs. Todd, Elizabeth Taylor. And then Michael Todd was killed in a plane crash. Eddie started comforting Elizabeth Taylor, and it turned very rapidly into a romance. But all the personal sympathy went to Debbie because she had been abandoned by her husband.
It's interesting the way the personal and the professional meld for her, because really, you said she's a spunky woman, and that spunk was shown in her personal life and then also in what was her favorite role, and that's in the film The Unsinkable Molly Brown.
She even titled one of her books Unsinkable because she was, really. She kept going, and, you know, she had these bad marriages and she had financial setbacks that she wrote very candidly about. But there was something indomitable about her, and that was shown most clearly in this film, for which she was nominated for an Academy Award, and she regarded as her best film achievement, because it was about a woman who brings herself up from very humble origins and becomes successful and rich and cannot be defeated even by the sinking of the Titanic. And if that's not a parallel with Debbie Reynolds' own life, I don't know what is.
Richard Berrios, musical film historian, currently at work on a book for Turner Classic Movies called Must-See Musicals, 50 Show-Stopping Movies We Can't Forget. Nice to talk to you, Richard. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm gonna learn to read and write. I'm gonna see what there is to see. So if you go from nowhere on the road to somewhere and you meet anyone, you know it's me. I'm gonna move.
Enron, WorldCom, Bernie Madoff, Galleon, some infamous names from some of the world's largest corporate crimes. We know what they did, corruption, fraud, theft, but do we really understand why? Eugene Soltis is a professor at Harvard Business School, and he wanted to know the answer to that question. So he spoke to and corresponded directly with more than four dozen former top executives involved in some of the largest white-collar crimes, including Bernie Madoff and former Tyco CEO Dennis Kozlowski. Those conversations are the subject of his new book, Why They Do It, Inside the Mind of the White-Collar Criminal. I spoke with Eugene Soltis recently, and I started by asking him about what he learned when he contacted Enron's former chief financial officer. Just to remind people, back in the year 2000, Enron was, what, the seventh largest firm in the United States? $100 billion market cap. In April 2001, MIT had named Enron the e-business of the year, but of course it collapsed entirely. 20,000 people lost their jobs. $60 billion in market value just vanished due to the corporate malfeasance that went on there. For those people who don't remember or wanted to excise it from their memory. So you spoke with Enron CFO or former CFO Andy Fastow.
Yes.
Now, first of all, what was he like?
He's smart, clever. He's oftentimes in the media, he was painted as this individual that was just behind the scenes helping the CEO and the chairman. But really, he's an extraordinary financier, except the challenge is he was actually trying to be too clever in many instances.
Yeah, I mean, so he served 5 years in prison for his role in the scandal, which included what? Hiding some of Enron's losses, the big losses, they were put off the balance sheet.
Off the balance sheet, right? Yeah. The idea was to really accelerate the good things that were occurring at Enron and feature those and figure out a way to essentially paper over, remove from the balance sheet, temporarily hide or delay the losses.
Okay, so when you talk to him then, I mean, that's just like sort of the tip of the iceberg of what went on in Enron. I mean, people remember they were like creating companies that didn't exist to move money around, things like that. But did Fastow give you any insight into why he did? I mean, he was the CFO. The buck should have stopped with him. I mean, why did he do it?
So Enron is an incredibly complex story of all the financial transactions. But Andy gave one example, which I think helps clarify. And he gives examples. Put ourselves in the position of being back in high school and asking our parents, can we go to a party at our friend's house on Friday night? Our parents say yes, under one condition, that you can't drink any alcohol at the party. You say, sure thing, mom, dad, and they give you their blessing, and you go to the party. And you arrive at the party, and a buddy of yours, as you enter, offers you a beer, and you decline politely, saying, my parents said I couldn't drink, and in deference, I'm not going to have a drink. Then an hour later, another friend comes up to you and says, you know what, I got something new. I actually have this new thing called a beer pill, and it has all the same wonderful effects of creating this intoxication, but you just eat it and swallow it. And so you sit there and think about it, and you're like, oh, I told my parents I wouldn't drink alcohol, but I said nothing about eating alcohol. And so you happily take the pill and get drunk with your friends. And technically, you feel like you're following the rules that you set by your parents. But as we can see, is if you were to drive home after that, you would have all the same detrimental and terrible impact of driving under the influence. Yeah. And that captures the mentality of Enron's executives. Technically trying to find really clever ways to, quote, follow the rules, but in the process, taking the principle and really just stomping on it.
Yeah, completely. I mean, as I hear you explain what the example that Fastow gave you, it sounds like a tortured rationalization for the fraud that they were perpetrating.
The challenge in speaking to many of these executives, these are brilliant, brilliant people in many instances. And the problem is you don't start thinking of these things as gray, ethical, moral dilemmas, but instead you think of them as problems. And you, being a clever person, need to try to figure out a solution to the problem where, in some instances, there's a good reason why we have regulation. You're supposed to just not do it. Yeah. Not find a way to ostensibly go around it in a new, clever way.
Well, so I wonder how much of this has to do with, the culture at Enron and perhaps in other parts of American industry, American corporate culture. Like, they all thought they were the smartest guys in the room, and so therefore, by virtue of just that, you know, was it easy for them to think, or maybe not even think, that what they were doing was unethical, criminal? Like, the idea just never even crossed their mind.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that I learned from this project is we all actually do things that are wrong. For example, we all speed a little bit if you drive.
Speak for yourself.
I'm going to follow you home.
I walk.
I'll walk. Okay. Most people speed. And then they rationalize it as saying everyone else is doing it. The speed limit's too low. I won't get a ticket if I go only 5 miles over the speed limit. But what's really critically stops people is they need to feel what they're doing is harmful. And if you feel what you're doing is harmful, you never even consider that as an option. But the problem is in white-collar crime, people at the time, even really smart executives, don't feel what they're doing is harmful because they don't actually see the victims on the other side of the table. They're distant. They're abstract.
Well, so except ultimately in the case of some of these or many of these crimes, there are victims. I mean, just sticking with Enron here, we were talking about the 20,000 people who lost their jobs when Enron collapsed. Many of those people had their entire retirement savings also vested in Enron, which vanished. I mean, did Fastow ever talk to you about, does he have any feelings, any regrets, any remorse for the pain he caused those people? They are victims of what he did.
This is the part that it took me a while to really appreciate as I was doing these conversations, both with people at Enron, but more broadly, is really the lack of remorse. And that's because it's hard for people to actually identify how their particular action led to the devastation of all these people losing their 401k accounts because they thought they were trying to build an amazing firm. Right? This is part of their image of themselves, is to create the world's greatest firm. And so to the extent that people lost their accounts, retirement accounts, as the firm went down, they look at that as also a personal tragedy, that what they were building was also going downhill. But actually figuring out how your particular action, how moving this number around on a spreadsheet, how doing this particular deal ends up leading to someone not having a retirement account anymore, it's a very circuitous, and there's a lot of steps between that one action and someone losing their account. And it's hard for people to viscerally, I think, feel and realize that.
I have to say, I mean, this is so disappointing to me. Not you, but this realization, because these guys, I mean, just 2 minutes ago we were saying they thought themselves the smartest guys in the room. And if they're so smart, they can't figure out their role caused this? I mean, this sounds to me like a moral failing in them. They should be smart enough to realize that they destroyed the lives of thousands of people.
I
mean, is there a moral failing here? Is that what we're getting at?
I agree. And this is, I think, a really difficult challenge of people that are in prominent positions to actually, when you're controlling huge enterprises that whose your decisions impact thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, to actually remember in the end, kind of in that visceral feeling way, that your decisions today and tomorrow will affect all of them, each individual person, rather than this kind of amorphous mass. But most people end up, you can't resonate. An amorphous mass doesn't resonate with you.
So let's talk about then what you learned about how to get a sense of checks and balances, for lack of a better term, in the process of doing business in America, especially at these high levels, where, you know, ideally, if those checks and balances are there, people are thinking about the potential ramifications of their decisions. I mean, what did you learn about how we can do that?
One of the larger solutions that we think a lot about is corporate governance solutions, bringing in independent minds into the boardroom so to kind of spice it up, bring in different views and opinions. The problem is a lot of times, and Dennis Kozlowski, the former CEO, talked about this when he was convicted of embezzlement, is that he saw a lot of these independent directors really ultimately there to serve him. And so technically these people are independent, but like everyone, many times independent directors still have a vested personal interest of being on the board. It could be well-paying, could be prestigious. So are they going to push back in the way to actually create that independence? But ideally, that's what we want. We want to make the world a little bit more like the classroom, where these decisions during corporate training or business school class are not oftentimes that difficult to resolve. They're oftentimes looks pretty black and white, like something like insider trading. But in the boardroom, these things look a lot more muddled.
So let me ask you one last question, because we're almost out of time here. I mean, you are a professor at Harvard Business School, and many, many people point to, you know, places like HBS as this is where those muscles and habits for doing that self-checking, that soul-searching, that the building the structures that make America's future business leaders have ethical considerations as part of how they do business, it ought to be crafted and honed in at Harvard Business School. I mean, you see some logic behind that there, right?
And I think we do that. The trouble is that the time they spend thinking about this, it's ultimately 2 years, or in an ethics class, it's 40 or 50 hours in the classroom. They then go, let's say they go work at a bank. That's equivalent to their first 3 days of work. So whatever culture they're now in within their bank or whatever firm they go work overwhelms whatever they've honed very, very quickly. And so this is where one of the challenges that we face is how do you get back that spirit? How do you rekindle yeah. those things that you might have been thinking when you had the time to step back and think? And
well,
so
yeah, I mean,
one of the challenges.
Make it more than one class or have it be a part of every class taken at a business school.
Well, I would like every year or two when people come back for the reunions, if they took a day. That might be a way.
That's a great idea. Well, Eugene Soltis is a Harvard Business School professor. His new book is absolutely fascinating. It's called Why They Do It, Inside the Mind of the White Collar Criminal. Professor Soltis, thank you so much for coming in today. It was really, really interesting to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
There are 41 college football bowl games this season, but only three of them really matter because they're going to determine the national championship. In college basketball, there's March Madness and the Final Four. In football, there are the semifinals. They're going to be played on New Year's Eve. Number 4, Washington will take on Alabama in the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl. Number 3, Ohio State takes on number 2, Clemson in the PlayStation Fiesta Bowl. And yes, those are really the names of the bowl games. The winners will meet in the national championship on January 9th. Mike Pesca is here and now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, Alabama is the defending national champion. The Crimson Tide are really a juggernaut. They've been the top team in the country all year. Are they unbeatable?
No, they're not unbeatable, although I don't think that premise is going to be especially strongly tested by Washington. I mean, it may be, but let me just convey to you that it is a 14-point spread, which doesn't necessarily mean anything except the people who have to put money on this think that Alabama is that much better than Washington. And Washington definitely deserves to be there, but it's not just undefeated. I'm not going to say that Alabama seemed flawless, but they do seem a class above whatever competition will come their way, be it Washington or the winner of the other semifinal.
Which is including who?
That is Clemson against Ohio State. Now, there is an interesting game because they both have flaws, but they both have the potential to be extremely strong offensive teams. What I would point to is that Clemson has this great quarterback, Deshaun Watson, very exciting, but they lost once this year, and they lost to Pittsburgh. And Pittsburgh kind of confused them. I would say Pittsburgh outcoached them. The coach of Ohio State is Urban Meyer, and they've been off for over a month. It's been a month for Urban Meyer to sit and strategize and stew. And so I think the smartest mind, my opinion, the smartest mind in college football is going to find a way to at least give Clemson a lot of problems, and that would make for a very red but very interesting Ohio State against Alabama national championship game.
So in those games, what in particular do you think we should watch out for?
Well, the offensive line of Clemson isn't that good, so who's to say if Deshaun Watson will be running around for his life? The score, if it's a very high-scoring game, that could favor Clemson in the other game in Alabama, unless something goes really wrong. And by the way, they could be trailing after two quarters, and don't say, Mike, what are you talking about? Watch the full game, because they have this tendency to turn it on and crush opponents at the end.
It's hard to argue with Alabama being in the Final Four. They're 13-0 on the season, but is there any argument with the other three teams in the playoffs? Did the system get it right this year?
I think so. I think that what it does is if there are four teams in the playoff, you push down where the argument is. So, you know, you can make an argument that some other team deserves to be there, the fifth or sixth best team. But there's no question that you're giving the opportunity to the best team in the country and at least three of the next four. You're never going to have anyone be totally happy. But by the logic of how they've set things up, I think it's good. And I compare it to the NFL, where there really are only two teams and maybe two other teams, like the two very good teams. Teams are Dallas and New England, and the other two teams who might be okay are Atlanta and Kansas City, and that's all I want the NFL playoffs to be. I say get rid of those other, you know, 10 teams that are in the playoffs. I want to see a college football-esque format in the NFL playoffs this year. I am alone in thinking that.
You can do it because it's your birthday. Happy birthday, Mike Pesca.
Oh, thanks.
Mike Pesca here, and now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Nice to talk to you, Mike.
You too.
Flint, Michigan still doesn't have clean water. It's been more than 2.5 years since the city switched its water supply and lead first appeared in its tap water. But a new investigation by the Reuters news agency finds that even with Flint's water crisis, there are many neighborhoods across the country with even more serious problems and some places where 40% of the children have elevated lead levels. Michael Pell is a data journalist with Reuters. He reported this story with his colleague Joshua Schneer. Michael joins us from New York. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there has been so much attention placed on Flint, Michigan, but you and your colleagues found that there are, what, nearly 3,000 places across the country with worse lead poisoning than Flint? Where are some of these places and how much worse?
Well, they're scattered across the country, and some of them are much worse than Flint. These are communities, some of which have been reported on in the past, like Baltimore, Philadelphia, Cleveland, and others of them are areas that have flown under the radar. South Bend, Indiana, St. Joseph, Missouri, a little mining town in Missouri called Viburnum. And some of them, nearly half of the kids tested have lead poisoning.
Wow. I'm looking here at your story. And in Warren, Pennsylvania, for example, you found that 36% of children have tested high lead levels. That's just one of the places. And how did you find this new information or how did you gather this data?
So earlier this year, Josh and I did a story about a town in Indiana called East Chicago. And this town made headlines for a couple of weeks over the summer after the mayor decided to evacuate a housing complex in the city because it was built on a Superfund site with high amounts of lead. And Josh and I looked at a CDC report that was written in a few years ago that said that there was almost no risk of children being exposed to lead poisoning because almost every kid in the town was being tested. And the rates of lead poisoning or elevated lead levels were in line with the rest of the country. So Josh obtained some data that I took a look at from the Department of Health in Indiana that was down to the census tract level. And what we found was that, yes, the town itself had a rate that was in line with the rest of the country. But no, not even close to 100% of kids were being tested. And no, the rate for that census tract that included the housing complex was not in line with the rest of the country. It was much higher than the rest of the country. And it was one of the census tracts that had the highest rates of elevated lead levels in the state of Indiana. And so that made us want to look at granular data across the country. And Josh and I issued open records requests in all 50 states to obtain as much data as we could on a granular level. We wanted to look at data by census tract or by zip code.
And just to be clear, I mean, the level of granularity here is important because the census tracts, as you remind us in your story, are county subdivisions of about 4,000 residents and zip codes on average, what, 7,500 people?
That's right. That's okay. Right. And so what you could see in a county is, oh, sure, there's no problem countywide, but there are neighborhoods that are absolutely struggling with lead poisoning.
Right. So where in these places that had these spikes, these very disturbing spikes of high rates of lead poisoning or high blood lead levels in children, what were the causes that you found? Is it the traditional ones we think of? Paint, old infrastructure, pipes?
Often it is aging housing, old infrastructure. In Milwaukee, they're replacing their lead pipes. They also have old housing with paint. In St. Joseph, Missouri, there are houses there that are more than 100 years old. And during that time period, they have been covered with lead paint again and again and again. There's also the soil. Cars used to run on leaded gasoline, and the fumes, the exhaust, would settle into the soil. Old industrial sites. Some of the communities you might not think would have a problem based on the age of the housing and income levels, traditional predictors of lead poisoning. But you would find out that this community is located in the Lead Belt, a mining district in Missouri that has a long history of lead mining, smelting.
Right. Well, so let's talk about St. Joseph, Missouri in a little bit more detail because, I mean, you opened the story with a little boy, 2 years old, named Caden, and he has high lead levels. But then you say within 15 blocks of his house, how many? 120 children have been poisoned since 2010?
That's right. So I went to St. Joseph in November. I met with a pediatrician whose children had also had high lead levels because of the age of the house that she lived in. And then we just took a walk around a neighborhood that we knew had high percentages of kids with high lead levels and ran across LaRonda, who was sitting on her porch watching her son play. And just in the course of chit-chatting with her, she said, "Yo, you're here for a story about lead poisoning. My son Caden was nearly hospitalized last year because of his exposure to lead." And what it came down to, it wasn't hard to find people once you got into these neighborhoods, once you identified the neighborhoods.
Wow. I mean, so just in St. Joseph, you have poor little Caden. And then did you also mention that the pediatrician in St. Joseph's, or one of them, her
yes.
daughter had high lead levels?
Two of her daughters, as
Both,
a matter of
two
fact.
Two of her daughters.
Yeah. St. Joseph is a city that really values historic preservation. And so they have some beautiful Victorian homes that were built in the 19th century, including Dr. Brownfield's home. And shortly after she moved in, her two youngest daughters were both diagnosed with high lead levels.
Hmm. Now, what impact? Because we're talking not just, you know, what's been happening in the past year. We've been talking about things that have been going on for years in some of these communities. What impact
yes.
have these high lead levels had?
Well, researchers have found that even low levels of lead exposure can permanently impact a child's cognitive abilities. Not only that, but can impact their emotional state as well. So Josh interviewed a family in Milwaukee, a young man who was exposed years and years ago, and he is still struggling with lead exposure today. He has problems regulating his emotions. He has had frequent run-ins with the police. He has cognitive problems. And he told Josh he thinks that this affected his entire life. He could have been something different if not for the lead paint that he was exposed to in a rental property all those years ago.
Wow. So you did this new analysis that looked at numbers at a much sort of in smaller geographic chunks, essentially, to find out
yes.
where the real hot spots were. Did county level officials know about these particular hot spots? Have families living in these areas been able to get the appropriate medical treatment or assistance in keeping their water clean, maintaining their homes?
Sometimes when we went to a community, they said, "Absolutely, this makes sense to us. We do know that we have a problem. But we don't have the resources to deal with this. We need more money. Federal funds have been drying up. CDC's funding for this type of work has decreased dramatically over the years. State budgets have not kept pace with the problem." So sometimes county and city health officials were aware of the problem, but oftentimes they weren't. We've gotten phone calls from city managers, elected officials who have said, "We had no idea that this was a problem."
Wow. Well, I'm seeing a quote here from Dr. Luis Gallup. He's a pathologist and a county health officer in South Bend, Indiana.
Yes.
And he says that their funds to tackle the lead problem in South Bend have dwindled, and you have this quote here where he says, "We are the lowest of the low in terms of public health funding." I mean, I'm not saying that that's true in every county that you visited, but in cases like that, the future doesn't look too bright in terms of tackling this problem.
It's going to be interesting to see what county and city health officials do with this information now. And will this galvanize public support for tackling this problem? We saw that with Flint, Michigan. The city received $170 million in federal aid recently. That's about 10 times the CDC budget for state assistance.
Do you think that there are more places like the neighborhoods and the communities that you discovered in your reporting, but for some reason didn't come up in your data analysis this time?
That's very possible. Testing rates for children are abysmal across the country. Even in states that require testing of kids, for example, at ages 1 and 2, there are huge swaths of the population that are not being tested as they're supposed to. So if we had more data, there could be communities that would show that they have a problem as well.
Well, Michael Pell is a data journalist with Reuters, speaking to us about the investigation about high lead levels in many communities across the United States. Michael, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
New Year's Day will mean a hike in what you pay at the pump in many parts of the country. State gas taxes are going up. Pennsylvania has the highest in the country. It's 50.4 cents per gallon. Come Sunday, it'll go up by nearly 8 cents. A week later, tolls on the Pennsylvania Turnpike will jump by 6%. This is the 9th year in a row the tolls on the Pike have gone up. So, if you want to drive across the state from Ohio to New Jersey, it'll cost you $3 more for a total of about $51. It's only $37, though, if you're using the Easy Pass. In Michigan, the gasoline tax will also go up on New Year's Day. It'll rise by 7 cents a gallon. This will be the first hike in the gas tax in Michigan in 20 years. The extra revenue will pay for road and bridge repair. Nebraska, Georgia, North Carolina, Florida, and Indiana will also see higher taxes at the pump on Sunday. Happy New Year. There is a famous billionaire known mostly by his last name who's got an active role with government. The name is not Trump. It's Penske, as in legendary auto racer Roger Penske. Roger Penske is celebrating the 50th anniversary of his racing team this year. And as WDET's Quinn Kleinfelter reports, Penske continues to take the lead on the racetrack and on public projects in the city where cars are king.
In May, officials in Detroit gathered to celebrate the opening of the main terminal for the city's new light rail line. Michigan Congresswoman Debbie Dingell led a parade of public figures praising the man they call the driving force behind the rail project.
You could not have picked a better person to have named this new headquarters after than Roger Penske, whose vision and leadership for this region has made it such a better one.
But even when talking about trains, the 79-year-old billionaire businessman's thoughts did not stray far from the sport he's become synonymous with.
You folks see this vision. Don't stop. Don't stop. Keep your foot on the gas, as we would call it in a race car. We need to continue.
Roger Penske's world is built on wheels, a trucking business, car dealerships. Yet Penske says he decided against becoming a full-time race driver.
You know, I wanted to be a Chevrolet dealer, and GM told me early on that they didn't want their dealers to be racers. My dad loaned me $50,000 to get into business, and he took it out of his savings account. He was retired, so I had to pay him back, too. So it was a pretty easy decision for me to make that, to be a businessman versus a race driver.
Instead, Penske created his own race car team, an organization that eventually won 16 editions of the world's most famous auto race, the Indianapolis 500. No other owner has come close to that. Penske fought for those wins both on and off the track. One of his drivers was penalized during the 1981 Indy 500 for passing numerous cars under a yellow caution flag, handing the victory to legendary racer Mario Andretti. But Andretti says months later, race officials reversed themselves and gave the win back to Penske.
They gave in to the pressure of an outside lawyer, which Roger brought in. This is one that it's hard to swallow because that organization intimidated everyone. They dragged this on for 6 months.
Penske's reputation for making things happen made him a natural to help Detroit officials prepare to host the 2006 Super Bowl, even when, Penske says, he had to personally oversee beautifying some of the city.
I remember with a paint crew, and we'd go around in a van and we'd say, paint this building, and can we tear this building down? And I think right up until the kickoff, we missed a couple probably.
Penske says the work created a desire to do more in the public sector.
I think one of the things I want to see is this city, you know, be a great city again, and I think we're on our way.
Penske organized teams to pick up trash in downtown Detroit. He lent his name and cachet to numerous projects, like the light rail line. But his efforts have not always been well received. In 2006, Penske negotiated with city officials to pave over a small portion of Belle Isle, a park that also hosts the annual Detroit Grand Prix auto race. But the head of the Belle Isle Conservancy, Michelle Hodges, says critics continue to blast the presence of a cement slab some refer to as Lake Penske.
The fact that there is a cement paddock there does impact the tranquility and the experience of park users, as well as any noise associated with the race.
Penske counters that his group has also poured millions of dollars into improving Belle Isle. After all, Detroit is his backyard. Yet Penske is still consumed by the Brickyard, the nickname for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Especially, he says, the one that got away, the 1995 Indy 500, when none of his cars could find enough speed to qualify for the race.
Had to walk down that pit road with the two drivers, one on each side, 100,000 people saying, wow, you didn't make it, and that makes you a much better person.
Penske went on to win many other races and championships after that, and he says his work on the track and in the city of Detroit is still far from reaching the finish line. For Here and Now, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.